and welcome to CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. This is Open Sources Guelph, your weekly current affairs discussion show. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scott, Karl Marx, Elvis, Tesla, Hertz do solemnly swear to give us the best show ever today. That's my swearing in. It's on topic. It's on theme.
That is my real name.
That's my real name. Say my name!
You can listen to Open Sources here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online by going to CFRU.ca and clicking on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. You can also listen to us anytime by downloading Open Sources, the podcast version from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we are going to Queen's Park, where Premier Kathleen Wynne is under siege yet again for apparent mismanagement. On the one hand, teachers' unions got government money to cover negotiating costs, and on the other hand, there's the perhaps ill-advised partial privatization of Hydro One, which began today. Then we will head out to the West Coast, where there are new concerns being raised about housing prices and who's buying in Vancouver's swankiest neighborhoods as the time comes for government intervention to cool the market. And then finally, we will consider the cozy relationship between Enbridge and the University of Calgary. Is this a sign, or a further sign, that corporate interests are beginning to have too big a stake in our post-secondary institutions? But first... Of course, you've probably heard about yesterday's festivities. Sunny Ways had a sunny day as Justin Trudeau was sworn in as the 23rd Prime Minister of Canada at a very public ceremony at Rideau Hall. And for a man who was priding himself on openness and transparency, he certainly kept, well, the secret of who was in the cabinet until the very last moment. True Nixonian secret-keeping on the part of Justin Trudeau there. So that's where we will begin today. It is a 30-person cabinet, 15 men, 15 women, plus the Prime Minister himself, who will not only be Prime Minister, but will also be Intergovernmental Affairs Minister, and he will also be Youth Minister. So, Scotty, we'll start with perhaps surprises. Who made the cut that surprised you the most, or among the most?
Well, I don't know about surprise. There were some names I thought, well, yeah, for sure. I thought one of the surprises was Chrystia Freeland was rumored to be the finance minister. We were going to see the first female finance minister ever. Now, she got international trade, which wasn't, I mean, that's not too shabby.
No.
It's an excellent pick. I think in looking at the whole scope, you'd say, yeah, I can see why they put this person here and this person there. A good ton of veterans as well. I wasn't really super surprised. There was no one that, other than that, and Christopher Lee not getting finance. I didn't. I have no idea who Bill Morneau was or where he came from. So that was a bit of a surprise. Like, who's that guy? But obviously, he's party, and that's the thing when you're designing your cabinet. It's, you know, who are the loyal soldiers? Where can I put them? Plus, you know, pleasing or at least trying to accommodate certain provinces, Nunavut.
You also don't have a robust investment portfolio, so you wouldn't know who Bill Morneau is.
Like, oh, he's a money wheel, right? Of some kind. Of course, he has to be to get that job. I thought Mark Garneau's transport was interesting because, you know, you got to put an astronaut in charge of transport. You have to. You have an astronaut on staff. And other people that I hadn't heard of, but I was surprised once I read his bio, Harjeet Sajjan, National Defense, because, I mean, they're looking for the next James Bond. They don't have to worry about Idris Elba. Just get that guy. I was reading his bio. I was like, he did what? He's known for kicking Taliban ass. It's like, and then they put him in charge.
And he seems like such a pleasant man.
Yeah, he's like, hey, National Defense, Canada, we are in good hands. We are in absolutely good hands. And yeah, the whole... of course, the whole 50-50 wasn't a surprise in terms of gender. Mm-hmm. And the diversity, too. I mean, they definitely covered all of the bases that they said they were going to do. And the openness, too. The whole the festiveness of it. I honestly don't remember a cabinet swearing in quite like that. I kept waiting for them to – and there was audible cheering, too, the part that I watched. It was like people cheering outside like it was some kind of, you know – number 23, numero 23, Justin Trudeau. And like, ah! That's what I was expecting, but It was pretty close. You could hear the people outside like, yeah, yay, Catherine McKenna.
You know, yeah, that was like, a bit weird. It's like she's, I guess maybe because a lot of people there were local Ottawa and maybe they know her from city council.
Yeah, but I mean, even pre-Harper, like I don't recall this whole kind of, I remember the picture of the walk, which they were making a lot of, the
right.
Trudeau's first walk in 68, where they look really, really badass, and that John Turner,
the very reservoir
some
dogs,
guy smoking,
yeah.
And it's like, a little bit more levity now, and of course, no smoking.
No.
And it must be weird for Margaret Trudeau. I mean, not just, you know, a place you probably never thought you would be after going through that probably two or three, at least three times, right? With minorities and majorities. So it would have been strange for her, I think. But in a good way. It's like, oh, my God, I'm back at this? Wow.
She didn't seem to mind.
No. She seemed to be enjoying the whole thing.
Yeah, she did.
Grandma.
and, of course, the little Trudeau kids were adorable. And there was the downward angle of them looking in the camera and being just cute as buttons. But to get back to
impossibly cute. The whole thing.
To get back to the ministers, though, there was a lot of editorializing on Monday. And I guess it was mostly on Monday that seemed to come to a head, where it was like talking about tokenism. And actually, there was some of this after the fact, too. But they're like, well, how is he going to fill up the cabinet with half women? Blah, blah, blah. And
typical.
unfortunately, and I think it was the Beaverton that said, you know, Trudeau to have half 50% of cabinet women, interest in merit in the cabinet goes up 5,000%. But you look at any one of these women, they're very qualified.
Powerhouses.
Yeah.
I read in the bios, it's like there's no slackers among them at all.
The new science minister, first of all, actual scientist, unlike insurance broker Ed Holder or creationist Gary Goodyear.
Don't get me started.
So she's a scientist. She was a medical geographer. She was a professor at the U of T, and she wrote a book about trying to track down the causes of the Spanish influenza epidemic of 1918.
That was all a fraud, wasn't it?
It's not the moon landing, Scott.
There has to be deniers on that as well.
And another woman, of course, we should definitely mention is... what was her? The Justice Minister, Jody Wilson-Raybould, first Aboriginal woman to be Justice Minister, and that's going to be a huge portfolio when and if the inquiry comes down. That's going to be following her. But she also has an exceptional resume. She was a regional chief in BC. She was a Crown prosecutor. She's highly accomplished. So, you know, looking at the list of women. This wasn't tokenism. These were very, very qualified women, and it sort of makes a lot of the stuff actually that we're still hearing seems moot, because there was a lot of, I don't know, armchair quarterbacking. There was a McLean's piece posted online yesterday. There was like the cutting room floor version of Trudeau's cabinet, and included like names like the obvious names people thought were going to make cabinet, like Adam Vaughan and Andrew Leslie and Bill Blair, even Lloyd Longfield in that list. But, you know.
And there's still time. I mean,
well, I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, well, isn't that a good thing that you have backup rather than, you know, moving Julian Fantino around?
Ugh.
You know, if somebody fails, it's good to have other qualified people who could back up, I would think.
There was that great piece by Laura Payton in the McLean's about, you know, why did Julian Fantino hold all these portfolios?
Right.
It was really kind of flimsy resume, and yet he managed to run all that stuff or into the ground or whatever. But but that's the past. You want to talk about like a new start? It's a new dawn. It's a new day. This is it in spades. It absolutely, like, if you can pick it apart all you like, but I mean, and not speaking as liberal, because I'm pretty much nonpartisan, I'm impressed. And if I know I'm tough to impress with stuff like this, but look at it, it's like, man, they put a lot of thought in this, covered all of the bases, covered the whole country. And it was, there's a few fresh faces. I think, is it 18? I want to say 18 of them have never been MPs before.
Yeah.
And say, well, that's a majority of them haven't been MPs before, but that's going to happen. MPs are not. I mean, they've got it going on.
And there was a lot of name changes, too. I mean, this is kind of cosmetic, but, I mean, at the same time, the Ministry of the Environment is now the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change.
What? It exists?
Yeah.
So much so, we renamed the ministry. Wow.
Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development is now Indigenous and Northern Affairs.
I think the tendency is to get away from the word Aboriginal.
Yeah.
It's just Indigenous people.
Yeah.
And I tend to lean towards First Nations, but...
Yeah, and I try to use that one as well. And but I think this is sort of a UN thing, the, to move away from the Aboriginal label.
Yep.
Fisheries and Oceans is now Fishery, Oceans, and the Canadian Coast Guard. That is Hunter Tutu's portfolio.
Because the Coast Guard took a beating, right? So they're saying, look, we're gonna work on that. So.
And then the other big one is John McCallum is Immigrations, Refugee, and Citizenship Minister instead of just Immigration and Citizenship. Again, that's sort of outlining what's going to be a priority
and
for that
huge.
Portfolio.
And that's huge. Full plate if they're going to make the quota, which will they or won't they? That's you know, going to be the next, other than Paris.
That's a logistic thing, and a lot of people are hung up on the number. And what I'll say is, you know, it's highly ambitious, but there's nothing necessarily wrong with ambition. And if they can't make 25,000, but if they give it a good go and they give it a good try, there's a group here trying to raise money for bringing a family, Syrian family, to Guelph.
Yeah, and I think there's groups like that across Canada sprouting up right now, either faith-based or otherwise. So, and that's a fantastic thing, because that was the Conservative plan, and it was like, well, we want private people to handle it, but they want private people to handle everything. Private people can't handle everything, especially when it comes to like an international effort and coordination. So now that they've renamed the portfolio to and added refugees on that, that's like, that is a huge signal.
And they move, and it seems like they're moving quickly too. There was the announcement today that the long form census is coming back. They're trying to get that ready for March or May.
Is this a census year proper? I guess
long
so.
Long-form census, the half, mandatory long-form census.
Yeah, because it's usually on a year that ends in a one, but this is the halfway
this
point.
This would be
right?
The halfway, yeah.
So that, wow, so they managed to bring it back under the wire. Did we lose? Yeah, because long-forms were every 10 years, right, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this, or no, there's, and then there's a short census and in every 5 years. I don't know, many years ago I was a census taker. I should know these things. I'm sure it's changed since my day. How many cartons of cigarettes do you smoke? Never mind. who knows? But they need data. We need this data to make the country work. That much I remember from being a census taker was like, you know, if you're losing the data, then and you people will give census takers all kinds of resistance. But the long form census is a very good thing.
And then the full text of the TPP was released today as well.
Oh, did you read it?
I haven't had a chance to read it.
How many gazillion pages?
But from what I understand, a lot of because there's a lot of interest in this. There's a lot of provisions about what's going to happen with public domain. Apparently, a lot of that's true.
So this new government's going to be very, very busy.
Yeah,
never a dull moment.
And then I found this on the National Post. Apparently, you can't access the old 24/7 videos of Prime Minister Harper anymore.
What?
They took those down.
They were classic. Somebody's dumped them somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure. Somebody
is editing them right now.
They're going to end up on Retro Ontario one day.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, so it's things are moving pretty quickly, and it seems like we've I don't know how if you noticed this, but I was watching the National last night, and then it was on. They were doing a scrum after they announced the long-form census today. It seems like the media is already getting kind of bitchy. You know,
how far can they push it kind of
yeah,
thing?
Like, yeah, like Karen Valesky was like, well, they came down to scrum after. They didn't have a lot of answers because I guess it was their first day. And it's like, dude, do you remember when you couldn't even go up to the third floor without getting a Conservative boot up?
You're getting clobbered, yeah. That's
yeah,
right.
It's and then, you know, they're talking to, I can't remember who was making the, one of them was Jean-Yves Duclos, the Minister of Family, Children, and Social Development. And I can't remember who the other fellow was making the announcement. But they were talking about the long-form census. And they were kind of drilling them about, but are you going to send people to jail if they don't fill it out? Are you going to send people to jail? It's like,
has that ever happened?
It's never happened.
Right.
There was the one woman who was found guilty of not wanting to fill out the census.
And made her community service or something, probably.
It wasn't even community service. What did she get? She got, like, the...
Write an essay.
It was a conditional discharge. Like, she got what Brazo got, conditional discharge, where basically it's, yeah, we found you guilty, but you don't have a criminal record about it.
And now we have no record of her because they have no personal information on her, right?
So. But, yeah. So it's, you know, they're going to town over this. Are you going to send people to jail? Are you going to send people to jail? It's
no, like, but well, Harper would have.
Well,
you're
going
to get deported if you don't fill out your census
form. This woman, she came to trial during the last term. This was in 2011 she refused to do it.
I remember the refusing. I didn't even know she went to trial.
She went to trial. And this was in 2014 it was finally resolved.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
You're all going to jail.
A couple other notes. to do with other parties. First, late breaking news. Rona Ambrose has been named interim leader of the Conservative Party.
Yeah. You've heard it here first, folks. I didn't even know that. So.
Well, it was just on Twitter. Everybody on Twitter was tweeting.
Everybody gets a copy of the Fountainhead.
She did. In true conservative fashion, she took three questions and left.
That'll go.
But
over
I mean, I will give her credit for at least appearing in front of the media. The outgoing prime minister or the last prime minister has yet to appear in front of the media since election night. He sneaked in the back door of Rideau Hall to tender his resignation yesterday and sneaked out again. He went in the back door to the caucus room today. So I mean,
he'll have to show up for his official portrait, though, right? Or maybe he'll just get it done off-site.
Isn't his portrait done already?
I don't know. I thought they did it when you were done.
Well,
didn't they?
Well, whatever.
There'll be a stamp, too.
The point is, I know I got some flack from some people about being anti-Harper during the campaign, but, I mean, take the loss with some frickin' dignity.
I guess the wreath laying would have been the last public.
Yeah, well, except it wasn't there wasn't any talking involved. It was just
No, but he was out and about.
Yeah, that was the last thing. And then, like,
I'm not talking to you guys.
I remember CTV was, like, stalking him, and there was some footage of him in his neighborhood back in Alberta
delivering papers or something.
I think he was just walking around
with no feds, no guards on him.
I think he had still had a guard. I'm not sure.
I think once you've been in the big chair,
you're
covered.
And then the other one I liked is Tom Mulcair came out yesterday, and basically. I don't know if you saw the press conference or the scrum.
No, I missed it.
He says, look, our primary goal was to get rid of Stephen Harper, and we did it. We did it. He's gone. And I'm just...
What's your problem?
I just find it curious that Tom Mulcair apparently is taking credit as being Justin Trudeau's puppet master now. But
yeah, that is odd.
Also, his first appearance in public since election night.
These guys are laying low. But yeah. at least he can speak.
Yeah, well, I will give Tom Mulcair credit for at least coming in front of the media.
Yeah,
unlike other people who we've named. But that's
this will be probably our last bash at Harper. So, you guys and your anti-Harper rhetoric, I've never wavered personally. Right? Have I ever looked like you? You recall my famous election night declaration when he first got elected with a majority. So I never. Adam didn't waver either, but I don't know if we were like super anti. Like, we don't sit here for an hour and complain with the government.
I didn't have Harper derangement syndrome, at least I didn't think I did.
I'm a credit where credit's due kind of guy, and he doesn't get any.
All right, let's talk about another derangement.
Yeah.
It's not good days for Kathleen Wynne. Let's get the Hydro one out of the way, because I think we can probably both agree this has bad idea written all over it.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hydro One shares went on the market today, went on TSX today. It's been called, so far, the biggest IPO in 15 years. So it's the biggest initial public offering. That's what IPO stands for, if you're not businessly inclined.
Well, it's not I'm pissed off, no.
But what's interesting is apparently about 10% of the shares are being flipped, which means people buy them and then quickly sell them for a small profit. So that's, if you know sort of business practices of the last several years, that's really not a good thing. That seems to be a common occurrence with a lot of stock buying these days. But more pressingly and certainly more long term, the Financial Accountability Office at Queen's Park is saying, although this will be a tremendous boon in the short term in terms of bringing in revenue, Ontario may end up losing $500 million a year due to the sale, which...
And that's coming from in-house.
Yeah.
That's not all the independent people are saying, selling Hydro is a bad idea. Let me take you back to the Mike Harris days. Not even the Conservatives could do this. And it was under Eves, I think, where it was finally going to, go up for sale. And that point would have been the highest IPO. And it didn't happen. So, in these cases, it always, there's a couple of things happen. Number one is that exactly what you said. It's all about return on investment. It's nothing to do with, do we have a steady, stable, secure power supply for the province, which was the whole idea of the original Ontario Hydro in the first place, which was subdivided by the Harris Tories.
Right.
And now being sold off by the austerity light, in my view, government of Wynne. after all of this, they hum and haw, and then it's, we really need the money. I could bet you if you go back in time and listen for the discussion on the selling of the 407, which was to artificially balance the books in this province, I'm sure the Liberals were against that. This is the exact same thing. And of course, what happened with the 407? The price went up. If it's in private hands, it's going to go up. They'll say, let's let the market handle it. It will go up. And this is only 15%. The goal is 60. Get ready, folks. I mean, the bill went up. What was it? It went up on the weekend, like 3.4% or something. Mm-hmm. So the bills that were already gone up pre-opening. It was like the day before they said, we'll just put the price up. So peak hydro since 2010, which is when the smart meters were rolled up, has gone out 77%. Peak is when everybody's turning the coffee maker on, right? So everybody's, the bills are, 77 isn't double, but it's pretty darn close. And you can bet now that it's that there are private interests involved. Yeah, sure, they're going to raise some money, but the only way it can go is up.
Yeah. And I think, I can't remember who was pointing it out, but the Ontario Hydro is one of the worst in terms of energy companies performing energy distribution. It's not one of the great companies. There's a lot of management problems, and there's a lot of questions about why is the price going up so much? Why is Ontario Power so expensive when we have an energy-rich province right next door? We ourselves are exporting energy many times of the year. Why are we kind of paying through the nose for it? The typical response always seems to be about, just conserve more. It's like, that only gets you so far, too, if you're, running a business or...
Yeah, and it's okay to say conserve more. I mean, that's what you want to do. Yeah. But when you're just lobbing money at the thing, let's go back to the gas plants. And I, didn't agree with Hudak on much, but he was making a lot of noise about the fact that was just like $1.1 billion down the toilet. Now they're selling this to raise $1.83 billion or whatever it is. It's like, it just seems crazy. And a lot of it is to do with the management. Listen, have a look at that sunshine list and look for the top numbers. It's all hydro people. There's hydro people like in the millions. And it's not just wages, too. The fact that it's so subdivided, like we have Guelph Hydro.
Yeah.
So there's all these little subsidiaries as well, and they're all, doing their thing, and it works all towards the big picture. And the interesting thing was this past week, they'd said that the pension funds wanted it all, eh? The pension funds said, and the Caisse de Dépôt in Quebec, which is a Caisse de Dépôt's credit union, isn't it? Mm-hmm. These people just wanted to buy it outright. It's like, we'll take that. You don't want it? And I think a lot of people wouldn't mind that because they, in some ways that would benefit them.
Right.
And the pension plans, as opposed to just the whoever the heck's buying the shares these days. And what will happen eventually when it does hit that 60%, somebody will buy it all.
Yeah.
Somebody will come in with lots of billions, a Trump-style character, and buy it all and own it all. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, what happens? Like the price is whatever the price is. They decide that day. You'd be paying like a buck a kilowatt or whatever.
Yeah.
Sorry to be the voice of doom, people, but
it's not good. And
no.
Yeah, there. I mean, and there. I often think the sunshine list is a canard, and it's sort of a straw man.
It is in a way, but I mean, this is
But I mean,
associate
I
assistant making $1 million. It's like what? Like why?
Yeah, I didn't.
Why?
I was before you interrupted. I said except in the case of a lot of the hydro things, a lot of the hydro people, because I mean, yeah, it is so decentralized, and I don't see how privatizing is. Even partial privatization is going to make things better.
So stop
in the
it.
Short term.
Stop it, Ontario.
That seems to be the thing. Is everyone's saying, cut it out. Like, don't do this. Stop doing this. And they went and did it anyway. No one would have, slapped. Well, they probably would have enjoyed the Schadenfreude. But if they had said, okay, we'll pull the IPO till we have more concrete numbers about this, no one would have said anything, after a couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, when they're telling you in-house not to do it, it's not a good idea, and then they do it anyway. It's like they don't care.
What are you afraid? You're going to piss off Sue Ann Levy? She's already pissed off.
That's right.
Anyway, one of the things she is pissed off about is the situation with the teachers. I believe all the teachers and all the support staff have new contracts now. I could be mistaken because of the messed up negotiations, which have all the teachers' unions negotiating twice with their local boards and with the province, so depending on what the issue is. But the new issue coming out is that the Liberal government in 2008, 2012, and then just this last year have been giving the teachers' unions money to cover their negotiation costs. And Scotty, you're a union man, so.
I just have a reputation as a union man. As a card-carrying union man, I have to say that I don't get this at all. I've never heard the like. In all honesty, I've never heard of this whole. And of course, the perception is, as pointed out by Patrick Brown, and others, who's the PC leader now. It's like it smells bad in that, you know. Well, we're giving them money for expenses, and in this time around, it was like, well, we're just kind of estimating. We don't really know. There's no receipts. Who does that?
Yeah.
Like, this is another example of like. I mean, I may be a union person, but the fiscal aspect of it, you need to take care of that as well. You can't just say, oh, well, like, here's $1 million because we went over and negotiated this. I've never heard, like, you're on opposite sides of a table here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, oh, well, by the way, well, we'll take care of your dinners and that because we went too long. So that just smacks of a little too cozy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the unions involved is the union I happen to belong to is CUPE. It's like they took the money. But I mean, of course, if they're going to give it to you, you're going to take it. But is it, are they, well, seriously, you know, you're not going to say, oh, no. In principle, you probably should.
Yes.
You should say, no, I don't want that $500,000. Yes. You keep it. That would, the optics of that would be great. But instead, we've got this sort of like, hush, hush. But it's going to be probed by the Auditor General, right? Because the payment, the total payments from 2008 to now has been like $3.75 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge.
Yeah.
For like between three, was it OSSTF, ETFO, and CUPE. Now, CUPE isn't just, CUPE is support staff.
Yeah.
It's not, and some of these other unions, the OSSTF support staff were one of the other ones too. They're not actually teachers. It's like everybody else from the cleaner to the electrician to whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this, and coupled with that too, is the whole two-tier thing. And why they decided to split that, I have no idea. Because it's like, oh, well, that's, they do this whole, oh, that's a local issue, we can't talk about that. Oh, no, that's a provincial issue, we can't talk about that. That's part of why this has taken so long.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, wages, we can't talk about wages because that's provincial. And it's like, well, we can't talk about safety. Like, safety is a local issue.
Yeah.
Like, why don't you just go by the Ontario Green Book and then safety's covered, right? But no, it's, and some of the safety, I mean, considering what goes on in schools now, I sound like a really old man. I was like, you know, the schools now. But it seems that there's things like poor communication within the schools and classrooms, and sometimes it can be tough to find an administrator. And that's considered a local issue. It's like, where the hell is the principal?
Yeah.
I need backup, and they're not there. So anyway, but that's, you know, that, I guess that's one of the issues to be sorted out. But, it's something else.
This came from the legislation in, when was it, I guess, 2009.
Yeah, not that
after
long
they,
ago.
After they got reelected with, or, no, it was 11 after they got the, after the, la, 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 la.
I remember talking.
The minority. Yeah.
They won
the minority.
I remember talking about it on the ballot box.
Yeah. So this is kind of like the first time it's really been like implemented in full from the beginning of the process to the end of the process. And what have we seen? Well, it took almost 2 years to get from beginning to end with all these unions. I was curious what you thought about the sick days, because that seems to be the elephant in the room that's going to arbitration.
Getting paid for your cumulative sick days when you're done?
Yeah.
That you've saved?
Well, not only that, but there is the thing where you have up to 131 days where you would get 90% of your pay per day, and then you could come back for a day, and then it would start all over again. You had to have that, what do they call it, the refresher provision.
Yeah,
but now they're talking about getting rid of the refresher provision. You can just be on unlimited sick leave.
Well, I mean, if you're offered that many days in particular, then there's something very wrong.
Mm-hmm.
191 days a year. I mean, yeah, that's huge. And sick leave is, I know, is a bone of contention among teachers, and of course the government as well, because I know in a lot of places it's been cut from what it was. I think it's in some places down to like 5 or 6 sick days. So it's sort of like, okay, guys, suck it up. But the whole, I never really did understand the, and maybe a teacher could explain it better to us, the getting paid out at the end of it. So, you know, if you're a teacher for 40 years and you were never sick, well, I mean, you were sick, but you probably just dragged your ass into school because the logic is everybody's sick anyway. Yeah. You get this chunk of change. And that to me seemed a bit excessive. There's no real explanation for it. But I think it may have been a holdover from when wages weren't so good for teachers, and it just sort of prevailed.
Yeah, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. This is where unions lose the working people who don't get these kinds of provisions.
Yep, I would agree with that.
When you're arguing over, you know, who gets to get paid for their sick days, and, you know, some people in this province have to go to work, otherwise they don't get paid at all. And, you know, when people hear that, it just, you know, it propagates this feeling that of the selfish union. When to repeat, where I think we need unions now more than ever.
Yeah, we're not bashing the unions or the teachers in particular, because we know they take a lot, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Teaching is something I would not want to do, just to be clear. But at the same time, if you can take 131 days off and get paid 90% of your salary, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that must be in the most extreme case of illness. If you're off,
I'm sure.
If you're off of that, isn't that a whole school year, pretty much? Because there's the
nearly
time off. 2 months off in the summer, right?
Yeah.
So, oh, don't talk about that.
All right.
The teachers are firing up the hard drives.
We'll take that as a sign.
They're coming for us.
We'll take a break here, and we'll come back with some more issues, and we'll just play some music and some PSAs for you right now. You're listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. 250 watts of community power.
We get the call, there's a big storm rolling in. In the rear view mirror, it's hard to see where I've been. Just relax, knowing all of us were built to survive. Notice the kids instinctively point out the road signs.
Every day I take the same roads, pick up the kids and it's a heavy load. Everybody, please sit down in your seats.
Jenny, what's your 10-8? That's Jenny Omnicord, and we're going to tell you what her 10-8 is, actually. That was Jenny Omnicord. Her album is called Days of Hard Drives. 10 years of Jenny Omnicord, lots of songs about her bus. And actually, her golden bus is downtown right at this minute, showing films, shorts on a bus.
Well, not right this minute.
Yeah, 6 p.m. Oh, Friday. No, wait a second. No, right this minute.
6 o'clock?
25 minutes from now, right this minute. I see. I'm still on the fallback, right? So that's my excuse, folks. I'm still an hour ahead. Southwest corner of Quebec and Wyndham, go watch some films on the Golden Bus, and it's like running all weekend. The Guelph Film Festival. More information on that, as you heard in the ad, guelphfilmfestival.ca. Definitely go check out the Golden Bus. It's a something.
Sorry, I was flipping through Twitter here, and Ezra Levant posted a photoshopped cover of McLean's. Omar Khadr is on the cover of the upcoming McLean's, and he's holding been photoshopped to show that he's holding a sword to a woman's throat. So
there's a guy I want to punch in the head.
Levant.
Just let me get that out there. That Ezra Levant, don't come near me. I'll hit you. I will. Probably shouldn't.
He seems like the sort that would sue, but anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Why did you punch me? Nah. Well, let's start with ethical oil. Anyway, on to other things. Let's start with somewhat ethical oil.
Ethical oil is later. We're going to talk about housing first. There was a report that the city of Vancouver came out with earlier this week that went to some of Vancouver's more pricier neighborhoods, and for about a year... actually, for about 6 months, they looked at almost a couple of thousand single-family detached homes were sold, learned that 66% of them were sold to people with, quote, non-anglicized Chinese names, the implication being that these are people from the Chinese mainland who are buying property in Vancouver, presumably taking part in what has become a bit of a worldwide phenomenon of investing in foreign real estate as a way to make money. And This has caused a bit of controversy. On the one hand, it has added fuel to the fire that Canada's housing market is exceptionally overpriced and is a bubble perhaps ready to burst. On the other hand, people are like, well, let's not demonize one racial group for being the source of all ills in terms of how much houses are costing now. But I mean, this is a serious problem, and I've had my one eye on this for a while, for the last couple of years. The houses are just insanely overpriced now. I mean, in certain areas, but you know, you want to live in Vancouver, Toronto, you're going to be paying through the nose.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem is, rather than tell it like it is and say it's the rich, it's the millionaires, presumably from China, they're from other places, but it's the wealthy that are doing this. And it doesn't matter where they're from, because if the rules are that it doesn't matter where you're from to buy a house, then it's, you know, it could be China, it could be anywhere. And I think that's the fatal flaw with this report, in that they asked a couple of realty companies, and the estimate was that 70% of these situations are people from China, which means, they did specifically say China, but that means mm-hmm. there are people from other parts of the country with money. And it's sketchy too, in that whoever the investor is, be it China or wherever they get the money from, they just kind of install a person in it. That person becomes the primary resident, and they're able, you know, the person that bought the property gets this tax dodge out of it, in that, oh, you know, my son lives there and he's going to school, he's the primary, and he makes $0 a year, so he can essentially write the thing off.
Yeah.
The focus should be, or is, at least Gregor Robertson, among others, was talking about affordable and fair housing, and that
Vancouver mayor, Gregor Robertson.
Yeah, Vancouver mayor. So therein is the problem. Rather than have something like something useful, like, and maybe it's coming, a national housing strategy to sort this out, rather than just have it all cash driven, then we're never ever going to see the affordable house for the working schmo or whoever.
Yeah,
because there's no end to this. If there's nothing to prevent it, people, you know, dumping this cash in the house, and then you have the tax dodge and the loophole, it's not going to stop.
The Financial Times had a statistic: 50% of all single detached homes in the entire Vancouver area are below $750,000. The average professional in Vancouver makes $42,000 a year. So yeah, that isn't the $3 million, $4 million houses that this report was looking at, but $750,000 for a house?
And some of them are decrepit too. Like, it's not as if you're buying a stellar, you would hope if you bought a house in Guelph for $750,000 that it would be your dream home or whatever,
yeah.
Right? But no, some of them are night. They're just shacks. Right. And then, you know, they come in with a digger and remove it and then build the $1.5 million or $2 million home. That happens a lot too, teardowns and retrofits and stuff. And then there's this other sort of subset of it too. This was specifically about detached houses, but then there's the empty condos. The condos with no lights on, they're just people.
Ghost apartments.
Yeah. Just money getting parked, and you know, there are people without, you know, housing is a human right. It was passed at the UN, you know, food, water, shelter, that kind of, it's up there with people need places to live.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have this kind of situation, they're getting shut out.
Yeah.
There is no hope. You have to just go somewhere else to live. And it's just, when does the bubble burst? Because I think that's what we're gearing for sure.
It's coming, and I'll refer back to a Toronto Life article I read back in the summer where they were talking about young professional couples buying their first home, borrowing money from their parents in order to afford the down payment. Getting a loan is the easy part because interest rates are so low. Getting a loan is the easy part. Getting enough for a down payment, that's where the trick lies, and that's where kind of these increased housing prices are hitting people, is with the down payment, because if you're paying like $500,000, $600,000 for even just a starter home, you need $20,000, $30,000 down. And if you're making $40,000, $50,000 a year, that's, and living in Toronto in an apartment, that's, you know, that's not easy to save for. And maybe you're saving for other things as well. Maybe you have a kid you have to pay for. But the ghost apartment thing is interesting, just to visit that, because there isn't a lot of profitability in a lot of the markets right now. So people are buying foreign real estate. there's too much cash in banks, which is one of the reasons why interest rates are so low, is because there's no money going out, and they're trying to make the money go out, because there's so much money parked in banks. So this is one other reason why people are turning to real estate. And then, I don't know how it is in Vancouver, but the problem, particularly pronounced in New York City, the 8th or the 10th most expensive city to live, Vancouver's number 4, by the way. In New York City, you could buy a home and you're paying thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars in property taxes. If you buy an apartment, you're paying maybe a couple of thousand dollars in property taxes. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people in New York City who are being, or the city of New York, rather, is being hosed because people are buying apartments, these ghost apartments they live in 2-3 weeks a year, maybe, and instead of buying homes or other buildings, and they're at huge tax revenue. Because people are playing a shell game.
And that's a problem when you commodify it, something that is seen as essential. This is what happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's never going to end unless there's two ways. Either the bubble bursts or there's more regulation on it, whether it's foreign ownership or you have to do something with this property.
Yeah.
And install people in it because it's ridiculous. And it all fuels the boom, too. I mean, they'll argue and say, well, the realtors are making money and this, but that's limited, right?
Longevity. It's going to look like oil patch. When the bubble bursts. I'm not saying if the bubble bursts, when the bubble bursts, all those realtors making huge sums of money right now, that they're going to look at the guys in the oil patch who are now having to head home after making a killing in the oil patch for years and years, and now
sell the truck.
Yeah.
Sell the tools.
Yeah.
It will come to that. It's just a question of when. Don't want to be the voice of doom, but these things boom and bust. It can only last for so long, and then something happens, like a 2008.
Yeah.
Right, where it's all of my other assets are gone. I got to sell the condo.
And remember too, when during the campaign, Harper was saying, well, everyone should own a house. Well, I'm pretty sure that was the sort of attitude that did lead to 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Low interest rates, pushing home ownership on people who couldn't necessarily phone home ownership, inflated prices on houses. Yeah, it's a recipe for disaster.
Enron style.
Yeah. All right, we're going to wrap. Speaking of energy, we're going to wrap up.
I'm on the segues
with,
today.
With a bit of a controversy out of the University of Calgary. They have a school at the School of Economics there, the Enbridge Center. Of course, Enbridge. They are the leading name in pipelines, and they have not been having a good week with the United States and not wanting to put on hold the examination of exploration of the viability of pipeline, the Northern Gateway pipeline. But then there's this news that the president, Elizabeth Cannon of the University of Calgary, might have been interceding on Enbridge's behalf and the business school named for them in terms of selecting students to get rewards and making staffing choices. And a number of faculty at the U of C have come out and said, yeah, this was corporates, people stepping in and telling the university where to invest their money in terms of research and development.
Yeah, although they're trying to say that they didn't. That SCTV sketch of Martin Short as a politician is like, I never said that. I didn't say that. That's what it seems like to me. So to break it down a bit, the University of Calgary has the Haskane School of Business, and then Enbridge sort of endowment was a subset of this.
Right.
So of course, when I see a name like that, like we know of Monk,
the Monks. Enbridge Center for Corporate Sustainability.
There you go. And so Haskane himself was an oil man. I mean, this is where this is where the money came from initially to start the School of Business. So the fact that there's a tie-in to Enbridge shouldn't surprise anybody if you do the old connect the dots. He's the current board chair emeritus, I believe, of the U of Calgary, and also the memoir was a great one, Building Ethical Canadian Corporate Champions. So with tone like that, you shouldn't be surprised that something like this Enbridge Center is an offshoot or was part of this. Now, there's a difference to me, I think, between philanthropy and this kind of setup.
Right.
And this is the worst kind of setup because in the past, and I believe we've talked about this before, like even here on campus, we have Massey Hall, which were the agriculture people. Mm-hmm. We have McDonald Hall, the tobacco magnate.
Mm-hmm.
Every town had a Carnegie Library, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was Carnegie giving away his millions, regardless of how he made them. It's like, here's a library. No strings attached. It's just there.
Yeah.
This one had tons of strings, including the whole trying to partner with Central Michigan University, which happens to be right where the Kalamazoo River runs, where Enbridge had a little accident and dumped thousands of liters of fuel into the river. Like, it just smells really, really bad. Like, of all the people you could partner with, you could have partnered with the University of Guelph. No. You partner with, you know, right where the Kalamazoo River runs. So it's like a publicity stunt, really.
Yeah. And they did hire a PR firm to promote the fact that they were investing in this school.
Yeah, so it's not the university doing the PR. It's this independent, so that's more money, right?
The disturbing
propaganda money, in my view.
The fact that a corporation was acting in corporate interest isn't surprising. The surprising thing is that the University of President Elizabeth Cannon sits on the board of Enbridge Income Fund Holdings.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so
more conflict
she has. Yeah, so she has 25,000 shares worth about $810,000. So you're sitting.
Smells
on,
even worse.
Yeah, you're sitting on $810,000. You mean to tell me you were acting on behalf of the university as a university president, and there was nowhere in the back of your head that I'm indebted to these people sitting on $810,000 of that is involved with them there? That ever crossed your mind any one time?
Yeah, I mean, that's a bit, there's obviously too much control. And, you know, if they're deciding who the academics are, they're going to run. And that's the guy, I think, was it Joe Arvai?
Yeah.
Was the whistleblower, I guess, who got the boots, because it was like, essentially, it seems like Enbridge didn't like him.
Yeah.
So they got rid of him. But, I mean, if it's down to you're influencing who the staff are in that arrangement, then, I mean, that's just a dirty deal. Sorry, there's no two ways about it. Now, Premier Notley has said, I don't know how much she can intervene, although the provinces are in charge of the universities, said that they're going to look at the conflict of interest legislation. And from what you've just said, it sounds like it's going to be really bad. Like, to the point where somebody might lose their job. I'm fairly sure that this school, in quotes, will now disappear because, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, you're right about philanthropy, too. Philanthropy is you know, granted, it was never completely selfish.
No.
But, you know, it was more about the legacy than the PR boost. It was more about, somebody like Alfred Nobel, for example, creator of the Nobel Prize, because he made a ton of money creating this thing called dynamite, which, you know, has its practical uses, but it was also being used for some exceptionally impractical destructive uses as well. And so his thought was, I'm going to take all this money I made making this thing called dynamite, and I'm going to turn it into a prize for people who are doing good things.
And
for
one of
mankind.
Them is for peace, right? So, yeah, you'd hope so.
So, yeah, that helps the Nobel name. Nobel is more well known for his prizes than for the fact he created dynamite now. But the whole thing with Enbridge here is they needed a PR coup to take attention away from a spill. I mean, again, the most predictable accident related to oil. Is it spilling? And, you know, the timing, this was 2010. The spill happened. The school opened in 2012. 2.5, and you know, you and me, $2.5 million sounds like a lot, but for Enbridge, this is a drop in the bucket in terms of buying a bit of goodwill. But they really seemed terribly interested in what was supposed to be an altruistic gesture in terms of, you know, developing, I don't know, maybe developing a talent pool, maybe creating a farm team for future Enbridge employees.
Yeah, but of course you can do all of that without giving to a school, but I think it would cost more money, and maybe that's it. It's like, you know, this will look good, and we're giving to the university. And, you know, there is lots of it that goes on, but not as open as this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that I think that was part of it, too, when the Enbridge name appeared.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes you see people in the fine print. One of the ones here at U of G is Monsanto, or Bayer. Give money to this institution. Bear in particular for bee research. You know, you have to wonder, and you could dig a bit into that and drill into it and say, well, what's going on there? Which is something we may do in the future. But but yeah, it's not as if it hasn't ever existed. But we're at the point now, like, is it the university creating the knowledge, or is it, you know, are you doing it to please the corporation? And I know it's been, over the years, always a balancing act to see where that fine line was, but I think as I always do, that the corporations are winning.
Well,
because they'll just say, there's no money. Oh, wait a second. Here comes Big Daddy with his big checkbook.
Well, right? Exactly. You know, in Alberta, universities get 60% funding from the government. You got to make up that 40% somewhere. So why not corporations? Unfortunately, sometimes those checks come with strings. They shouldn't, but they do because, I mean, now there's so much enlightened self-interest with corporations. What can you do for us kind of thing?
So if you want to send us a bunch of money, we'll change the name of the show to whatever it is within reason. Definitely not Enbridge, but...
The Pepsi, Mattel, Choco Box.
Trocadero Hour.
Open Sources Hour. Anyway.
But until that time.
Yeah. Send us a check. No. Before we sign off, too, we didn't get to mention this when we were talking about cabinet, but I do want to mention Stéphane Dion becoming now Foreign Affairs Minister. I think he got hosed in 2008 when he was leader, not coincidentally helped by Mike Duffy in that famous interview where he had to ask him to repeat the question several times. You're not supposed to. I mean, it's good form that you don't put out that clip, but Duffy put out the clip.
And look where Duffy is now.
Exactly. So I just wanted to highlight that, too, because I do think it's well-deserved, his appointment. Anyway, that's all for this week on Open Sources Guelph. You can stay connected to us at opensourcesguelph.com. Also, we are on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. And once again, you can download Open Sources on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, and you can listen to Open Sources on whatever conveyance you listen to find podcasts on. And if in case you're interested in listening to my other podcast, the Guelph Politicast, you can listen now to the first full-length interview I think anyone's done with our new Member of Parliament, Lloyd Longfield, who is currently sitting in or just finished his first caucus meeting. I will consult Twitter shortly to see what the status is on that. Anyway, you can connect with me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
And I'm on Twitter at Scotty Hertz, also on the Facebook quite a bit at Scotty Hertz. Scotty Hertz on the Facebook. And then there's the Spanner book, which I'm not even going to talk about anymore because I haven't had time to put any stuff on there. But you can find me. Just put in Scotty Hertz. I'm out there and the show's out there and you'll be able to find us. And if you want to get in touch with us too, that'd be great. If you have any topics for future shows, also great because we'd love to hear from you, whether it's local, national, international. This is what we do.
You know what else is out there?
What's out there?
The truth.
The truth is out there.
Stay tuned for Sounds Good for DJ Sounds Good to Me. I forgot her official title. DJ Sounds Good to Me. Here she's going to be here at the top of the hour with some
DJ
music.
DJ Sounds Good to Me. We'll play.
CFRU 93.3 FM, ZFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Keep it locked here for more news, current affairs, discussion. Here next week on Open Sources, Thursdays at 5 p.m. And until then, we will get you up to date with Simal Jazeera. See you next time.
Ciao.